You. Angus, thank you as well for leading us and hosting us and praying and with apt scriptures as well. It's much appreciated. What I want us to think about this morning is this question: what makes Christian leadership Christian? When is leadership just leadership? When is it Christian leadership? I think often the answer we hear is a Christian leader is a leader who is doing Christian things with their leadership. So there's a thing called leadership. Politicians use it to gain or hold on to power. CEOs use it to try and make a business successful. Pastors use it to try to make churches grow. And so the thinking goes, what makes Christian leadership Christian is what the leadership is being used for. If you take leadership and point it in a kingdom kind of direction, it becomes Christian leadership. It's Christian if it has a Christian goal. And I don't think that's entirely wrong, but I think it's profoundly incomplete. Because I want us to think this morning about the fact that Christian leadership isn't just about where we are seeking to lead people, but how we are seeking to lead people. It's defined not just by the ends, but by the means. And we've seen far too many examples of unhealthy leadership in recent days across the board, it seems, different denominations, different parts of the Christian world. And I wonder if part of the reason we've had a lot of unhealthy leadership is because our focus has been on where they've been taking us. And we've been thinking, well, there's churches being planted, there's Christians being trained, there are people being reached, things are happening, and we've not always been attentive to how people have been leading. Paul Tripp, you may have come across Paul Tripp. He's written some really extraordinary books on leadership, one of which is called Lead. And this is one of the things he wrote. He said, our definition of a leader now is strong personality, quick-witted, forceful, domineering, able to win the day in a discussion or an argument. No wonder we've produced a culture of ministry bullies who mistreat people. So I want us to turn to some words of Jesus in Mark 10 to, I hope, give us a different vision of how to exercise leadership in a Christian way. These are well-known verses. Mark 10, 35 down to 45. Because it's Jesus on how he wants leadership to happen in his people. So let me just read through these verses. They'll be very familiar, I'm sure, to many of us. So Mark 10, verse 35, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came up to Jesus and said to him, Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you, which is not a great start, if we're honest. Jesus is there and you say to Jesus, I want you to be my genie in the bottle kind of thing. Jesus said to them, he kind of plays along with it, okay, let's see where this goes. What do you want me to do for you? And they said to him, grant us to sit one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory. So they're thinking, okay, Jesus, we don't really get fully what you're on about, but we've heard the word glory a bit. Something's about to kick off. It sounds like you're about to start something. Someone mentioned something about a kingdom. So we want the best places in whatever this kingdom thing is that you're about to bring about. Verse 38, Jesus said to them, you don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized? And they said to him, yep. And Jesus said to them, okay, well, the cup that I drink, you will drink. And the baptism with which I'm baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand or at my left is not mine to grant, but is for those for whom it has been prepared. So that's that. You're going to go through some, you don't know what you're asking, but actually you are going to go through some of what I'm going to go through. You're going to go through a type of that. But this is not going to be about positions and grandiosity. Verse 41, when the 10 heard it, they began to be indignant at James and John. Indignant is a really strong word for anger. They're not mildly frustrated. They're not put out. They are veins throbbing out of their forehead level of angry. Not because I suspect, you know, James and John were just being so crass, but because James and John got there first. Actually, we were hoping for some of those positions too. So they began to be indignant at James and John. So Jesus is recognizing, okay, this is a teachable moment for everyone. Jesus called them to him and said to them, and this is the bit we're going to focus on, and if the disciples are slow to pick up on these things, we need to assume we are too. So listen to what Jesus says. Verse 42, you know, there's a lot they don't know, but he's confident they know this much. You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. So Jesus is saying, hey, this is how the world works. I don't actually have to persuade you of this. It's self-evident. Everyone sees this. It's just obvious. But the way the world does leadership and power is it uses it to lord over others. It's about me. This is what we do with power. We assert ourselves. We put ourselves above others. This is every level of power from the CEO to the, you know, traffic warden, whoever it might be. We put people in their place, which is obviously beneath us. We pull rank. We make sure everybody knows who the top dog is. We want to make sure we feel superior and that they feel subordinate. And Jesus says, this is common knowledge. We know this. This is just the way of the world. He doesn't have to prove it. He doesn't have to demonstrate it. It doesn't matter what period of time you're in or what culture you're in, what part of the world you're in. It'll be some version of the rulers of the Gentiles lorded over them and their great ones exercise authority over them. Now, just as an aside, I'd never thought about this before. A friend of mine mentioned this to me a few months ago, but when Judas goes to betray Jesus and he's with the authorities and they say, you've got to kiss the, I can't remember exactly how it's worded, but he has to kiss the one who is going to be betrayed. They don't know who Jesus is. And Jesus is there with his disciples. And I'd never thought about this before, but just the fact Jesus was there with his disciples, it wasn't visually obvious to the authorities which one of them was Jesus. In other words, Jesus wasn't sort of obviously holding court and sort of, you know, I've met pastors who always have to be the person who is the kind of the focal point of the discussion or the kind of, you know, their voice is always the loudest in the room or whatever it might be. I thought it was telling that actually it wasn't immediately obvious which of these group of people was Jesus. He wasn't kind of carrying himself in that kind of way. So Jesus is saying, this is just the way the world works. People use authority to lord it over others. And he calls his disciples, he calls us to be different. So verse 43, it shall not be so among you. Okay, that's how the world works out there. That is not going to be the case here. My kingdom, my domain is going to operate differently. That's them. This is you. And the answer isn't, you know, leadership's a bad thing and we need to all withdraw from having any kind of structures or authorities or anything like that. Churches need leadership. Spiritual authority is a good thing. It's not wrong to have authority and rulers and those kinds of things in this world. Jesus' concern is that we approach those things differently to the natural world around us. And Jesus is alerting us, because this is the way of the world, it will always be the tendency for it to be the way for the church as well. In other words, it's going to take no effort to be like the world and every effort not to. We're just going to always default into lording it over others and that kind of thing. We've seen that throughout, you know, church history. We see that throughout the Bible. I mentioned yesterday God rebuking the leaders of Israel in the Old Testament in Ezekiel 34, precisely because, among other things, again, he said, with force and harshness you have ruled them. That is, lording it over. So this is not a new issue Jesus is identifying. And we see the same concern elsewhere in the New Testament, that Christian leadership isn't to be like that. So Peter, in 1 Peter 5, verses 1 to 3, he says this: shepherd the flock of God that is among you, exercising oversight. Oversight's a good thing. Not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you. Not for shameful gain, but eagerly. Not domineering over those in your charge, but being examples to the flock. So there's three contrasts. Serving willingly, not under compulsion. So you're serving as a shepherd of God's people voluntarily, not because you've sort of been coerced into it or something else. You're not doing it for shameful gain. You're not doing it for what you get out of it in, you know, sort of ungodly ways. But eagerly, it's on your heart too. You believe in this. And he says, not domineering over those in your charge, but being examples. Again, not domineering. Peter is alerting us to the fact that it may well be possible, depending on our personality types and lots of other things, it may be possible to use our position in leadership to dominate others, to coerce others, to intimidate others, to threaten others. It's possible to use our leadership to have people agree to do things, not because the Lord is leading them to do that, but because they feel pushed into it by us. Paul raises a similar issue in Romans chapter 14, verse 23, where, again, he's been talking about these differing consciences amongst believers. And he says in verse 23, but whoever has doubts is condemned if he eats. The context is talking about what food some people think you can't eat and that kind of thing. He says, whoever has doubts is condemned if he eats, because the eating is not from faith. And then Paul globalizes the point by saying, for whatever does not proceed from faith is sin. In other words, if someone's doing something not because it's come from their own faith, but because they're doing it because you've pressured them into doing it, that's sin. I think of a pastor I know who's got a very, very strong personality. And I remember there was a situation where at his church, this is not going to identify him or the church because this is such a perennial thing. They were short of small group leaders. So, oh yeah, we all know which church that is. And there was a particular couple who one of the junior ministers at the church had asked about potentially serving as leaders of a small group. Lovely couple, would be great people to lead a small group. The assistant pastor had gone to meet with them and said, hey, would you think about this? And what do you think? And they sort of thought about it and said, we've got a lot on right now. There's some stuff going on with our family and some other commitments that we don't feel we're able to do that right now. So the assistant minister reported that back, and this lead pastor said, I'll go and talk to them, and went and met with this couple and came back to the assistant minister and said, they're going to lead. And the assistant said, oh, how come? I thought they couldn't. He said, well, I've made them. Now, he might have thought that was, I want to suggest that is a failure of Christian leadership, not an example of it. And we need to be, you know, some of us are naturally brasher, more bullish, stronger personality types, others of us less so. If you're someone who has naturally got a very strong personality, you need to be incredibly careful that people aren't just doing things because you've made them do it. Paul says, whatever does not proceed from faith is sin. I can think of other ministries where I've seen a leader push people into believing things, push them into believing the right doctrines, or what are presented as the right doctrines, but they're believing it because he made them rather than because they've been convicted of that in their heart. And the danger, and there's so many things that are dangerous about that. Not least when they move to another church and there's a strong personality who's pushing them in an entirely different doctrinal direction. So that is the danger for us. And I love that, it going back to that bit in 1 Peter when he says, not domineering over those in your charge. The antidote is, he says, being examples to the flock. There's a better way to be a compelling leader. And it's not by force of personality, but by the beauty of example. People see your love for the Lord. People see your walk with the Lord and think, I want to follow that person. I'm going to embarrass Ray by pointing to him as someone who is such a profound example to me of what it means to be a Christian man and what it means to be a Christian leader. I remember Ray, we had a group of pastors visiting a few months ago, and we sat down in the cafe at church, and Ray sort of poured out his heart to this group of pastors. And I remember talking with a couple of the guys afterwards, and they said, I would run through a brick wall right now if Ray Orland asked me to. And it wasn't because Ray was browbeating us or kind of pushing us or challenging us or forcing us or coercing us. It was just a compelling man of God, a compelling example, which is what we come to in the next verse, which is the ultimate example. Jesus says, it shall not be so among you. Okay, don't be like those guys. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For, here's the clincher, even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus describes himself as a servant, and he's obviously picking up on a massive theme throughout the Old Testament, the servants of the Lord, all of those kind of prophecies and expectations Jesus is applying to himself. And the point is, Jesus is not saying service is, you know, being a servant is one of the hats he wears. Being a servant is who he is. Living in Nashville, anytime you go to a coffee shop, the person pouring you coffee, they're not really a barista, they're a musician. And they're just waiting till they can, you know, be fully the musician that they've moved to Nashville to become. I've never met a professional guitarist who's just doing that while he waits for an opportunity to get a job in pouring coffee or something. It's always the other way around. But with Jesus, he is a servant. That is who he is. And more than that, he is the servant. Because Jesus is the, as we know, the ultimate example of service. He meets our greatest need and does so at the greatest cost to himself. He gives up his life as a ransom for us. There's no greater form of service Jesus could provide. He's got nothing more to give than he gave in his death for us and his resurrection for us. And I just want to pause and remind us, in case it's something any of us need to hear this morning, Jesus still regards you as being worth his while serving. He does love to serve us. He's continuing to serve us in his ascended place at the right hand of the Father, amazingly. So Jesus is the example for us of service, and he's offering himself here as a pattern for us. He says, if even the Son of Man came not to be served, the logic is we have no excuse not to follow in his footsteps, because the Son of Man is the one person you might think, yeah, you could imagine them not coming to serve. But if even the Son of Man has not come to... Sorry, I think I got that around the wrong way. But you know what I'm supposed to say. If even the Son of Man has come to serve, then we have even more reason to be servants ourselves. I think I've got that the right way around. You should serve is the bottom line. Okay. It's a matter of not trying to be above our master. We follow the servant. We're servants of the servant, but it's more than that. It's a matter of beauty. I've got a mental list of books I've not read, but whose titles have so ministered to me, I don't feel the need to read the book. There's that book, Elizabeth Elliot, I've seen it on your coffee table, Suffering is Never Wasted. Suffering is Never for Nothing. I'm sure it's an amazing book, but just the title is already like, oh, wow, yeah, thank you. I'll just take the title and let that minister to me. Or John Piper's God is the Gospel. He's the good news. Okay, here's another one. I've still not read this one, but the publication of that Thomas Chalmers sermon, The Expulsive Power of a New Affection. In other words, the way we say no to something sinful is to love the better thing more. To be more taken with what is right than what is wrong. It's going to be hard to say no to a sin if we don't love something else more than the sin. And what Jesus is giving us here is something that our hearts can be captivated by, because as we see the service of the Son of Man for us, there's a way to see that as the ultimate beauty in this universe. In a way that then moves our hearts gradually to more and more be wanting to follow that example of Jesus and think, I want to be like he is. And that is how we resist the danger of becoming like the people in the world around us. The way to avoid lording it over others is to be those who are so taken by the way Jesus himself used that ultimate power by expressing it in ultimate service, that becomes actually the kind of person we want to be as well. Because part of our vocation, if we're Christian pastors, is we are representing Jesus. He is the good shepherd, he tells us. One of the titles for church leaders is we are under shepherds. And what that means is there's meant to be a correspondence between the kind of shepherds we are and the kind of shepherd he is. In other words, people should be able to look at the way we lead and be able to accurately figure out something about the kind of leader Jesus is. Does that make sense? So here's a question to think through. What might people think Jesus is like based purely on the way that you lead? If they were to kind of extrapolate from your leadership what Jesus must be like, if that was the only source of information they had about who Jesus is, what kind of Jesus would they conclude is actually out there? Because it's not just that our teaching has to reflect the truth of the message he's given us, though it does, but our tone is meant to reflect his tone. Our disposition is meant to reflect his disposition. Our heart is meant to reflect his heart. And you will, I'm sure, be familiar with this verse, but in Matthew 11, Jesus tells us what his heart is like. He says, I'm gentle and lowly of heart. And so a good question for us to ask ourselves in leadership is, are we making it obvious in the way we lead the kind of heart Jesus has? Many of us will know the wonderful book Dane has written, Gentle and Lowly. But if people at our church were to write a book about the heart of Christ based on our leadership, would it be called Gentle and Lowly? Or would it be aloof and dominant? Or would it be insecure and fickle? You know, any number of things. We're meant to be making it easier for people to believe this is what Jesus is really like. This is how he leads us. And our great privilege is we get to try to reflect in our own shepherding by his grace the kind of shepherd that he is. And I just want to finish with one lovely sort of detail in this text, because back in verse 42, Jesus says, you know those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles, lorded over them. And I may be reading too much into a detail here. He doesn't say, you know the rulers of the Gentiles. He says, you know those who are considered the rulers of the Gentiles. And I think what Jesus is doing is he's saying, they're considered rulers. They look like they are where the power is. They look like they're the people who are significant. They look like they're the ones calling the shots and making things happen and shaping history. But it's just an appearance. The real power lies elsewhere. Because Jesus has just said, whoever would be great among you must be your servant. In other words, real greatness is service. They look like they've got the power, the presidents, the prime ministers, all of those guys. They look like they're the big shots. But actually, the most consequential thing in the universe is what Jesus is talking about here. That is where the real power lies. Serving others in the way that Jesus has served us, that is what changes the world. Lording it over someone can change their behavior. You can make people do things. But serving like Jesus changes people's hearts. It changes people from the inside. So we're not to esteem greatness as the world understands it, position, status. We're to esteem service. And if we're finding ourselves in Christian leadership or aspiring to Christian leadership, the motivation should be because that's a way I get to serve even more people. And it obviously means, and I say this because I've sadly heard pastors use this language over the years, putting people in their place, if you're a pastor, means putting them above you and not below you. Because that's what Jesus has done with us. He's made himself the servant of all. So I'm going to finish there. Ray, why don't you come up and tell me what I've missed, correct whatever I've got wrong. Any additional thoughts? How do you think about leadership? We've really rehearsed this, as you can tell.
Yeah. Sam, I've never noticed the word considered in verse 42. That's profound, isn't it? In the world today, in 2025, who are the real movers and shakers? Who are the real men and women of consequence? Social media, I'm not saying it doesn't matter. The evening news, I'm not saying it doesn't matter, but it can skew our perception of reality. Brothers and sisters, you who are following Christ in this very way, which is so magnificent, you are the rulers of the world. Humility, servanthood, sacrifice, self-forgetfulness, giving your life away, not even being thanked. What a great way to live. Mm-hmm. Jesus is ruling this world today. He has all authority in heaven and on earth. His eye is upon you. He has located you in history and in geography to be who you are, where you are, when you are, as you are, serving him selflessly. Whatever you're facing today, as you think about back home and what you're returning to, you have been prepared for the hardships and challenges of today. You've been prepared for it all your life. You're more ready than you feel. And when it would appear that you're losing, that loss, that setback, is part of God's, it's a gift. It's actually a catapult. We all believe, brothers and sisters, if we were to die for Christ, obeying him, standing for him, staying true, and we pay the ultimate price, we know that's a prophetic moment that will never be forgotten. Kierkegaard said, when the tyrant dies, his rule ends. When the martyr dies, his rule begins. We may or may not die a martyr's death. We will live with a martyr's heart and sacrifice and courage and selflessness. And we will have the same consequence as, you know, precious Thomas Cranmer and others. So this world has no idea who you are. What does this world know? Jesus knows who you are. And let's just, those who are considered rulers, Sam, I've never noticed that. Let's never forget that, okay? And let's just keep our wits about us and never leave Mark chapter 10. Thank you, Sam.
Do you want to mention that Francis Schaeffer book?
Oh.
The Lord's Work and the Lord's Way?
Yes, if I may. Thank you. And could I recommend two?
Please.
There's a little paperback published by Crossway. It includes actually two sermons by Francis Schaeffer, who was such a prophetic voice to my generation when we were back in university. The Lord's Work in the Lord's Way. In my mental universe, here's the Bible, here's the Word of God, and just underneath that is this little booklet by Francis Schaeffer. The Lord's Work in the Lord's Way. Sam, the distinction you made as you began, what is Christian leadership? It's not just accomplishing Christian ends, but walking in the ways of the Lord. The Lord's work in the Lord's way. That little inexpensive paperback, you could read that book, and then whatever your polity is, whether you have a vestry or a session or a classis or a board of elders, however that's designed for you, get that book into the hands of your fellow leaders, read it together, discuss takeaways, and just consider together, pray together, okay, what's going to be different from now on? What's going to be different from now on?
Yeah.
The Lord's work in the Lord. Now, could I mention?
Yeah.
Okay, and then I'll be quiet.
Oh, no. Okay.
51 years ago, last week, Jenny and I had the privilege of being at the first Lausanne Congress on World Evangelization, which Billy Graham, John Stott, and others cooked up. It was such a privilege. Francis Schaeffer was one of the speakers. Mm. The address he gave at that first Lausanne Congress became a little booklet entitled Two Contents, Two Realities. Here's what he was saying. Was anybody there at Lausanne? Anybody else? Wow. Are you familiar? Anybody familiar with this booklet? Two Contents, Two Realities. Yeah, okay. Here's what he was saying. First sentence out of his mouth. If we want to see something profound happen in this generation, and we do, then our churches and ministries must be marked, clearly, publicly marked, by two contents and two realities. The two contents are, one, strong doctrine. So friends, let's not cave to worldly ideologies. Let's stay true to Scripture. Strong doctrine, gospel doctrine. Second content, honest answers to honest questions. I love that. So we have a message from above, vertically, and we're attentive to, respectful of, aware of, interacting with the questions, doubts, and reservations of our generation. We're not ignoring them, we're engaging them. So two contents, strong doctrine and honest answers to honest questions. And we would both say, bam, let's go for it. Mm-hmm. Two realities. One, true spirituality, by which he just meant prayer and the power of the Holy Spirit. Not our own brash swagger, but humbling ourselves, walking in prayer, walking in the power of the Holy Spirit of God, looking to him moment by moment. True spirituality. Second, reality, and this had not even been on my radar. It was new to me. The beauty of human relationships. Sam, you just used the word beauty a few minutes ago. the beauty of human relationships. That very category has captivated me. And it took a long time for me even to begin to see the implications of that. When, you know, Sam and I just deeply, 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 deeply believe, and I still feel like I'm just barely beginning, but we deeply believe the watching world should look at us at Emmanuel Church and go, huh, that's interesting. And their hearts might even be a little bit moved, maybe even against their will. And they might think we're kind of weird in some of our beliefs, but they see sacrifice, gentleness, respect, joy, downright fun. And there's beauty there. We're not just running a religious institution. We're nurturing, cultivating, protecting, encouraging the rising of beauty. And when we disagree with one another, that is not a problem. That is a perfect moment for more beauty that will surprise our generation. Okay, there's my speech.
Thank you. Good, we've got a few minutes yet. It'd be good to open this up for discussion. Angus, thanks for...
Just before we do that, you mentioned the Schaeffer book, the two sermons. Do you want to mention the second one?
Oh, yes, thank you.
Because that might also be quite helpful.
Yes, right. Are you familiar with this little booklet?
I read it just a few weeks ago.
Oh,
on,
Angus.
I think, the recommendation of your podcast. So,
what did you think of it? Well, now, please say something. Yeah.
Well, it's just that I've read very little Schaeffer, so I was just sort of intrigued, and I thought, if Ray and Sam think so much about this, I'll download it. I mean, it really took less than an hour to read these two sermons. They're both very, very helpful. So that first one, The Lord's Work in the Lord's Way, just really helpful. Second one is entitled No Little People. And again, it was just something that just put a completely different slant on aspects of leadership and the exercise of leadership. Again, just very, very thoughtful. So, but it would be great to hear from you about it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Angus. Yeah, the main takeaway for me from the second sermon, No Little People, the main takeaway was what matters in God's kingdom is not the size of the ministry, but the consecration in the ministry. A small ministry consecrated to Christ is more consequential than a massive ministry that's sort of spiritually confused, double-minded, and so forth. Yeah. No little people. Every day this world belittles us. Every day this world treats us like we're nothing. And God says there are no little people. There are no little people in this room right now. Oh, I'm sorry. I'll try to calm down.
Thank you both so much. I'd love to hear thoughts on the role of speaking about and leading in evangelism in this context, particularly because it seems to me that a lot of the pathologies, the problems in leadership and in culture that you've identified can sometimes come hand in hand with a kind of single-minded, we've got to be the crack troops that take the gospel to the people who don't yet know Jesus, and so, to quote, if there are bodies behind the bus, that's fine because we're on a mission. What does it look like to kind of continue to have that zeal to hold out the gospel to those who don't know Christ without compromising Christ-likeness in leadership, gentleness, respect, all the things that you've been speaking about? Does that make sense?
I'll have an initial stab at that. Thank you for raising that. That's such an important question. Again, I go back to Ezekiel 34 and the Lord's rebuking of those shepherds. And I've got the quote right here. Let me read the fuller quote. The weak you do not feed the sheep, the weak you have not strengthened, the sick you have not healed, the injured you have not bound up, the strayed you have not brought back, the lost you have not sought, and with force and harshness you have ruled them. So strengthening the weak, healing the sick, binding up the injured, all of those things, those are not a distraction from evangelism. And the moment we think they are, we've misunderstood how the gospel spreads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because if those become a distraction from mission, we've ended up with a definition of mission that is not in line with what the Bible gives us. And again, it means we will be unpreaching with our behavior the very message we think we're trying to share with our lips. Yeah. Because if we're so zealous to get the gospel out that we're trampling people on the way, what we're telling people about the gospel is actually a very skewed message.
Wow. Thank you, Sam. Just to footnote, Sam. Beautiful community is missional. If all we're doing is trying to persuade people to believe our beliefs, we're only dealing in ideas. Those ideas matter. But evangelism is more. What we see in the book of Acts is a spreading community. And it's very interesting, in the summary verses, there are six sections of Acts, and each concludes with a summary section. In each, it says, the word of the Lord was spreading. But how was it spread? Was it just ideas going through communication lines? No. These little communities were spreading. That's how the word of the Lord was spreading. So if we're sitting at Starbucks, sort of as it were, respectfully debating with an unconverted person about what they believe, what we believe, we're engaging ideas, which is good, but the New Testament perceives evangelism as more. Come into this community. Look us over. That's where our credibility lies, not the cogency of our ideas only, but the beauty of our community, which those ideas create.
So John 13, 35 again, by this all people will know you are my disciples if you have love for one another.
Yeah.
Not if you just get a prepackaged, boiled down summary of the gospel and get that out. Actually, they'll know you're his disciples by love. There's a relational component that gives credibility to the message we're proclaiming.
I'm sorry, I've got the microphone again, and it's I'm really itching to ask you a question about leadership being exercised in community. As leaders, you ask questions about how people would read Jesus from the way we lead. Mm. We all have planks in our own eyes. I think I'm less self-aware than others. How do you, in the context of community, help leaders to see where they are not leading like Jesus? What are the mechanisms in the community to do that?
Yeah, I think the wording of the question actually gives us something of the answer, which is it's in community. I just think, you know, physically, God has physically made us so that we can't see our whole selves. I can see this amount of me, so I know I don't have ketchup on my shirt, but I might have, you know, anything on my back, and I need someone else, even at a physical level, I need someone else to help me see myself. And that is so much, you know, the case with us spiritually as well, and it's a question I've learned to ask, from having heard Ray ask it many times, which is, what am I not seeing in myself? That's a really healthy question for a leader to ask. And to have people around who actually have permission to answer it honestly. I remember Marcus Honeysett, who some of us will know, who's done some wonderful training for Christian leadership. I remember him saying to a group of Christian leaders, you're going to get some things wrong, right? And everyone was like, yeah, of course we are. So he said, what is the mechanism you have in place to find out what it is you're getting wrong? In other words, who's allowed to tell you when something you've preached isn't quite right, or something you've done didn't quite honor Jesus in the way that it should have done? So that's you know why it's good to have other people around us who have the permission, the authority to speak into our lives, whether that's plural elders, whether that's multiple pastors, whether that's a church warden, depending, you know, whatever our setup is. A lot of the situations where we've seen this go wrong have been situations where there may have been some sort of structure on paper where that was meant to happen, but in reality, things were kind of engineered so that it never would happen. So it's just worth thinking who is seeing into my life well enough to see what I'm not seeing, and am I making it easy for them to share what they're seeing rather than they risk they're going to get fired the moment they actually answer that question? I don't think there's a structure that is foolproof on that, because we can, if we're so determined, we can evade any kind of structure, but we need to be asking those kinds of questions. For some of you, it might be a spouse that can do that. Ray, any thoughts?
No, I love what you just said. A psalm that addresses the question of integrity and leadership is Psalm 101. And of course, we have to take this psalm. It's written by David, and he refers to his house, which would be his dynasty, and the royal court, the central leadership body. And he refers at the end to the city of the Lord, which is the community of God's people. Mm-hmm. And this is about leadership among God's people. One of the things that we did along the way, Sam, is we are an elder-led church at Emmanuel. That's our polity. But we stared at Psalm 101 for a while as leaders. We read it out loud. What do you see? What are your takeaways? What stands out? And we were helped, corrected, inspired. It built out new categories for our domain of responsibility that we might not have even noticed. So I commend to you Psalm 101 as a wardrobe into this aspect of Narnia.
Another passage we've used subsequently is Paul's address to the Ephesian elders in Acts 20. We've literally opened every elders meeting looking at that passage for about 3 years now. And sometimes we're noticing things we've noticed previously, but noticing them again helps. Yeah. But seeing the multifacetedness of just how Paul conducted his leadership and what we can learn from that was really helpful.
And we would open up our Bibles and read that out loud, verse by verse, and then just say, what do you notice this time?
Yeah.
It really helped us.
Well, related to that question, I found that sometimes godly men are quite reluctant when you put your hands on their shoulder and say, would you consider eldership? And they've needed encouragement. So what's the difference between a godly encouragement and, you know, you talk about being pushy and domineering. Whether you've got any thoughts on where the line is on those things?
Yeah, I was having a conversation with someone recently about this who I thought would be a wonderful elder, and who was hesitant. And I can't say thus says the Lord, you must be an elder. But I said, I think you would be a wise elder. I said, try to give concrete reasons why I felt this, he had the wisdom and the gifting. And said, would you do me a favor? Would you take some time to pray about it? And talk to other people who know you well and consider it. So I didn't ask him to do it, I asked him to consider it. I don't want to be too prescriptive, but still waiting to hear that.
And Paul says, if anyone aspires to the office of elder, that's a noble desire. He should not be embarrassed. But there needs to be, when a guy, his heart is reaching for, he doesn't have to be talked into it. His heart is reaching for that service and ministry. That's very significant. I love that.
Someone said to me years ago that the job of a pastor is to till the soil of humility into which everything else grows. Any tips on tilling? how have you found it best to keep that atmosphere, to use your word, the vibe of humility? We looked at Mark 10:45. How do you till the soil of humility in your church? What can I learn?
Well, humility is tricky, isn't it? I mean, if we want to display it, then we don't have it. I find self-deprecating humor to be really helpful. Sort of look at myself and roll my eyes, and to do that out loud and to share that together. I don't think you all do this anymore at Emmanuel, and you probably shouldn't. I hope you've grown out of it, but for some years we had what we called the Emmanuel mantra. We would say it out loud together sometimes. When you can't do something without kind of chuckling a little bit, I think we're going to a good place. It was simple. One, I'm a complete idiot. First thing we say about ourselves, I'm a complete idiot. Two, my future is incredibly bright. Three, anyone can get in on this. And when we declare that to our community, that's what we believe about ourselves. One, I'm a complete idiot. Two, my future is incredibly bright. Three, anybody can get in on this. We printed it out on little like calling cards, and when I would go get coffee at Starbucks, when I would pay for it, for the coffee, I would hand somebody that card, and it said those three things on it. Every single time, the person looked at it and smiled. And then I would say, and I mean, I see that as progress, because in our part of the world, Christians are expected to be smug and angry. And when Christians offer themselves to the community as self-deprecating with a sense of humor, that's not what people expect. So then I would say, and as I said the other day, we'd love to have you come visit our church if you'd like, but I owe it to you to tell you, I mean, this is us. I don't know if that's cultivating humility, but it's not stepping on the landmine of grandiosity.
Thanks, Pastor Ray and Sam, for sharing. A few years ago, I embarked on a journey to try to better describe or shift the culture in my church. And I realized our church was very strong on mission and vision, like get there and so on, but not how. Because they had no values. We had no values to fall back on. So I, after a lot of conversation with my closer brothers, I came up with a few, and I'd like to just share them, if that's okay. So quickly, it's community and connectedness to one another. So instead of thinking me and I and or even my cell group, how we church other churches and so on. Next one's humility and honoring one another. Repentance and resolute to resolving conflicts. That everything we do is incarnational and with integrity. Simplicity and sincere. And finally, transparent and teachable. That just happens to spell Christ, but.
Oh. It's helpful to have a set of cultural values, I think. It's good to be, most of us will have some kind of doctrinal statement or confession or creed so people can know what we believe. But a set of cultural values can then speak into this is how we try to be the people of God. I like those. Thank you.
Hi. Just about the sort of cultural values, I found that using the word family to describe ourselves kind of instills cultural values that we all know and expect from families, and it gets the good and the bad in there as well. Have you got any kind of overarching way that you view the church that encapsulates everything you've been saying?
Well, the Bible gives us overlapping categories, and family is one of the more significant ones in the New Testament. So that's a great one to keep using. We may have to kind of unpack it every now and then and be clear what we do mean and don't mean by that. But we mustn't exclude the other categories at the same time. We're a body of believers as well. We're the bride of Christ. But in terms of the sort of relational ground rules, family's not a bad place to start, I think. What do you think, Ray?
What Sam said. Now, our time is almost gone. And you have given us the privilege of being together four times this week. We're very grateful. Sam, what is something you would like to say to God's precious saints before we break up?
Well, I said it, I can't remember when I said it, but at some point I said growth in the Christian life is needing Jesus more, not needing Jesus less. I need to hear that on repeat, so I will offer that as an encouragement to you. What about you?
By God's grace, for his glory, let's keep on and keep on and keep on and keep on. And when we've done that, let's keep on. And because God is good, let's go have some fun. Let's enjoy the ministry. I think when we're enjoying the ministry by God's grace, the Holy Spirit is very present. So please, please, please don't depart thinking, oh my goodness, now I've got to do all this stuff and, you know, got miles to go. Just one takeaway from our time together, and go move with that, enjoy that, advance that by God's grace, and please don't feel like, oh my goodness, now I had a to-do list before, now look at it. No. Just one thing, and go enjoy the ministry. God be with you. Hey, I'll see you in heaven, okay? Bam. Thanks, guys.